I'll just announce it. Okay. You're listening to Back in the USSR.
You
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was David Bowie and Trent Reznor doing a really remarkable duet in 1994. Live performance. Now, Back in the USSR today is going to be a little bit different. Slightly different. I know there's been a lot of David Bowie tributes over the last week, seeing that he recently has died. And I'm going to give another one. You know, it might be a slightly individual kind of tribute, for I have a lot of respect for him, you know, as a musician, as a songwriter, just in a lot of ways. And I know, of course, this is not really what the show is about. You know, it's not what Back in the USSR is about. But I do actually want to talk about him in a slightly different light, in light of some of the things which, you know, really his development in his career and as a person, which I really respect, and which might not be immediately apparent, perhaps in the way which I mean it. But really, what I want to say is that I'm a communist, right? I'm a communist, and like you know, of course, I ran for political office for the Communist Party in Canada. And one of the things which is very, very central to communism is the idea of self-criticism. The ability to criticize yourself when you've done something wrong, basically, when you've made mistakes, and to change your behavior when that is the case. And like, you know, largely, you know, people like Mao Zedong and people like Lenin, when they talk about self-criticism, they mean it in a political sense. But, you know, it can mean in just about any aspect of life. It applies to all areas of life when it comes right down to it, this concept of self-criticism. And I find, out of any musician, celebrity, what have you, in that has emerged in recent decades, I think Bowie really is one of the most remarkable examples of self-criticism and self-transformation. And of course, you've seen like how many phases he went through in his musical career, you know, how he changed himself, changed his music, kept developing his music, even right up to the end with his last album, Black Star. Where, you know, it's just he's constantly evolving. He's constantly changing the kind of music that he's making, what he's putting out there. He's not, like, resting on his laurels or staying the same or just playing the same old stuff because it's what people want to hear. You know, he's constantly, just changing what he puts out. And that applies more to just his music. You know, it also applies to his politics and to his behavior as a person in general. Now, you know, of course, hearing the news about his death was rather hard for me to take. But what was also hard for me was something which came up on the internet this past week when, you know, I saw it kind of up on Facebook and stuff, and I was reading about it and seeing people's responses to it, and how some of the responses were just, you know, over the top, just accusational and hostile, and like were just to some extent, rather disgusting, you know, because, I mean, basically the story which came up is there was this one woman, her name's Lori Maddox. She was a teenager in the mid-1970s, and she claimed to have lost her virginity to David Bowie, right? This was illegal under California law at the time. This happened in California. This is when David Bowie was in L.A. in the mid-1970s, and there were some rather hostile people, you know, who were calling him a pedophile for this, you know, and were just, like, rapidly attacking him and stuff like that, and just going on and on about it. I mean, basically, there were a bunch of, like, anarchists and a few Maoists and people like that who were doing this. People, like, on you could say on the far left, you know, people who are, like, you know, and I kind of read into this, you know, I read into the actual details of the case, you know, and maybe the details of like David Bowie's career, like after that, and like, you know, how he developed as a person after that. And of course, some of the details of the case, I mean, Laurie Maddox herself does not identify as a victim in this case. I mean, you know, she's not like saying that, you know, going there and accusing Bowie and saying like he abused her or he raped her or anything like this. If David Bowie can be considered to have done something, you know, he definitely did engage in, you know, what can be called a reprehensible action there. You know, like he did break the law. He did abuse his authority. I mean, he's a man, he's a rock star, he's this person who's essentially, you know, putting this young girl, basically, 15-year-old girl, in a very compromising position. It's true. You know, he's abusing his authority, and that, of course, is he's abusing his position. And that is reprehensible indeed. You know, and this is something he definitely should be criticized for. Does that make him a pedophile? Absolutely not. And once again, we have to look at probably the best analysis of this, which I found when I was on the internet this week, is the following. The conversation about Laurie Maddox in relationship with David Bowie. The conversation was sparked by quite an excellent analysis by a woman on Facebook, arguing that while David Bowie's actions were wrong in this instance in the mid-1970s when he did this, what Maddox's own interpretation of what happened should be paramount in how we describe her, i.e. as a victim or not. As I understand this position, it has nothing to do with defending Bowie, but everything to do with defending and acknowledging Maddox's dignity as a human being, you know, who today is an adult, and she has no regrets about what happened back then, and the importance of listening to people and respecting their ability to explain their own experiences, which she did, you know. So she was not traumatized by this. You know, there was no suffering on her part. You know, no regrets about what happened in the past. And we have to respect her feelings on that, too. You know, so while we can say, yes, David Bowie did a reprehensible thing in the fact that, you know, had sex with someone who was underage and basically broke the law in that regard in California at the time, you know, where, you know, age of consent was 18 years old. And he knew that, and like, you know, and he still went ahead and did this, you know, sure, that's reprehensible and he can be criticized for that. But at the same time, you know, you have to understand where this woman, Laurie Maddox, is coming from as well, and respect the way how she feels about the whole thing. Now, and obviously this was not something that David Bowie made a habit of. In fact, he did not do this after that time. And of course, at that time, when he was in Los Angeles in about 1974, you know, this was a very dark time for him. Let's just say that. And this was also at a time when, you know, and he did another thing he definitely can be criticized for, when he became intrigued by Nazi imagery and for a while became enthralled by the, I want to say the ideas of fascism. You know, it's been well documented that Bowie was intrigued by Nazi imagery in the Coke-addled period following his album Young Americans. He'd been introduced to German history by British writer Christopher Isherwood, whom Bowie had met after a concert in Los Angeles in 1974. It was 2 years before he actually moved to West Berlin, following an intensely dark period in which he created his cold, thin white Duke persona. And he was terribly addicted to cocaine, flirting with the occult, surviving on red peppers and milk, and making bizarre claims in the press about Hitler and how fascism could help Britain. He was detained in Poland for traveling with Nazi paraphernalia. And in 1976 came the infamous Victoria Station incident when Bowie was pictured giving what appeared to be a Nazi salute, a claim which he consistently has denied. But after this period of time, when he moved to West Berlin, and this is where like self-criticism and self-transformation really comes into this, his time in West Berlin seemed to turn him against fascism. His mythologizing of the city had been tied to his romanticizing of old Europe, born of disillusionment with America and with standard rock music. Bowie later blamed his Nazi fetish on drugs and crazed quotes, and it could be argued that he was more into the indulgences of fascism than the ideology. And speaking of self-criticism, this is something I should frankly criticize myself for. Because yes, when I was 13 years old, I found the spectacle of fascism, you know, the parades, the uniforms, the flags, you know, all the, you know, public spectacles and the propaganda and all these kind of things, which, you know, were such a, you know, if you've seen any of Leni Riefenstahl's films like Triumph of the Will and Olympiad and things like this, you know what I mean. The kind of spectacle that the Nazis put on for propaganda purposes. I was very much interested in that, intrigued by that, enthralled by it. And it seems like Bowie was in a similar situation. But like me, he was able to transform himself, he was able to criticize himself, and he was able to get out of that. You know, move away from that, see it for the horrible thing that it was. You know, and when I look back on that, I realize how far I've come since that time. You know, when I made those mistakes. And I can criticize myself for making those mistakes, but also be proud that I am no longer in that position. And no longer am I fooled by the spectacle of fascism. And a similar thing happened to Bowie. You know, he was enthralled by the spectacle of fascism. But, and, you know, he was more into the, he was interested in the indulgences of fascism. And, but at the same time, his image changed. You know, this kind of, these remarks were coming out when he actually was saying these things about fascism. This was at a time of the rise of extreme right hate groups in England. And both he and Eric Clapton, who delivered a notoriously racist rant at a Birmingham concert in 1976, in the same year as Bowie's infamous salute, were name-dropped by those who'd organized Rock Against Racism as reasons for the organization's inception. But Bowie as racist seemed to contradict so much of who he'd been previously and where he would go in the coming decade. After all, from 1974 to 1978, Bowie was involved romantically with Motown singer Ava Cherry. Some of his problematic behavior was blamed on drugs, some on the Thin White Duke persona he'd adopted. During his final days in Berlin, the singer had seen his name sprayed on a wall. Some have even said it was the Berlin Wall, but that wasn't confirmed. And the last two letters of his name were framed in a swastika. And it disturbed him to see himself linked so explicitly to Nazism. And any appeal the imagery had became troubling. Dabbling in the darkness was not going to be his approach going forward, and references to fascism and the occult disappeared from his persona altogether. By 1979, Bowie had dropped the Thin White Duke image and referred to it as a nasty character for me. By the early 1980s, he was clean, divorced from his first wife, and healthy. And it was during this period that Bowie actually became very outspoken on the issue of racism. And he said when he went to Australia, for example, you know, which is a very racist society, very much a settler colonial society, he said this in 1983 during a Rolling Stone interview, he said, "As much as I love this country, it's probably one of the most racially intolerant in the world, well in line with apartheid South Africa. I mean, in the North, there's unbelievable intolerance. The Aborigines can't even buy their drinks in the same bars. They have to go around the back and get them through what's called a dog hatch. And then they're forbidden from drinking them on the same side of the street as the bar. They have to go to the other side of the road." You know, so he was calling white Australia out, you know, for its discrimination, you know, its oppression of indigenous people. Now, Bowie's history with race and racism is, like everything else in his public life, a study in phases. You know, whether you want to declare him progressive is debatable, but he seemed to at least believe in the redemption that could come from addressing ills as he saw them, especially as they affected his music and art. His Nazi flirtations stand in sharp contrast to who he'd been throughout his life, but they mark a necessary part of his evolution. In delving deep into the darkest facets of Eurocentricity and white supremacy, maybe Bowie saw an ugliness staring back at him that he couldn't stomach. It would be cynical to dismiss his public statements as simple PR moves even as he was decades removed from the Thin White Duke period. But it would be naive to assume that he didn't have to work to unpack whatever he'd absorbed ideologically in the mid-1970s, when, of course, there was such a huge resurgence of racism in British society, and he was impacted by that. Regardless, it's worth noting that this man was able to address issues that so many of today's white rock superstars seem all too eager to run from. You know, in an age when racism is such an urgent part of the national conversation, maybe America could use a few more David Bowies standing alongside the black and brown artists fighting for change. We don't need you to speak for us, but that doesn't mean you should remain silent. And that's what this person who wrote this article in Slate had to say about David Bowie and how he transformed. And you know, he said he did a lot of collaboration with African-American artists in the particularly in the 70s and in the late 70s and in the 80s. And he was very critical of how they were treated in American society. And he said so on MTV interviews. You know, he said, for example, with regard to the content of MTV, there seemed to have been a lot of black artists making very good videos that I'm surprised aren't being used on MTV. And of course, the person who was interviewing him defended that lack of African-American presence on MTV as narrow casting. And what he said after that was, the few black artists one does see are around 2:30 in the morning until about 6. And Bowie said that was not acceptable. So, you know, that was the thing. Bowie could change. Bowie could transform himself. He could criticize himself. He could understand where he went wrong and go forward in a much better direction. You know, he could unpack those periods of his life where, you know, he made mistakes and engage in reprehensible activities. You were said reprehensible things. And, you know, he could change himself going forward. He could take a different path. And that's really what I respect about him. You know, that's really what I respect about him. You know, what really makes him stand out to me is his capacity for self-criticism and self-transformation. You know, and that's a very important thing to be able to do. You know, and it's not something a lot of people, certainly in positions where he's in, you know, where he's like has celebrity status and stuff, it's not easy for them to do. But he was able to do it. So with that, I'm going to play another song by David Bowie. This is Slow Burn. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Time. danger of it all.
Hey, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That, of course, was David Bowie with Slow Burn, his album Heathen. Now, of course, like the there were two notable deaths this past week. You know, you could say in the in the world, of course, of acting as well as in music. And of course, the other one person who died was, of course, Alan Rickman, who many, of course, you will you know he played Snape. He played in the Harry Potter series. But of course, he had he was 69. He had a acting career going back decades, you know. And there was a very interesting article which came out talking about Alan Rickman, and also talking about David Bowie. And it came out on an interesting place. It came out on Electronic Intifada, which is a site, of course, about the defending the Palestinian cause. You know, Palestinians fighting for self-determination in, against Israeli apartheid. And this article was about how Alan Rickman wrote a play about the American activist Rachel Corrie, who was killed by Israeli forces in Gaza. And I believe it was 2005. And Alan Rickman actually wrote a play about that. And it was... it was very interesting. He had to actually fight very, very hard against censorship in terms of getting this play on air, particularly in the United States. But Alan Rickman, a lot of people don't know this, was very, very, very much supportive of the Palestinian cause. Like, he was part of the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. Where, of course, the boycott of Israeli products. Boycotting cultural events in Israel, not performing in Israel, not collaborating with Israeli universities or government agencies or what have you, or the artistic community in Israel, not basically boycotting the Israeli apartheid state. And Alan Rickman was a strong voice for that. He was part of that movement. And of course, this play, which came out in 2006, My Name is Rachel Corrie, is emblematic of that. This article was about David Bowie as well, who also has an interesting kind of connection, with Alan Rickman, and of course with this particular subject as well. So I'm going to read this article, which is by Abraham Greenhouse. And it says, "As the world mourns the recent deaths of legendary performers David Bowie and Alan Rickman, it is difficult not to draw a connection between the two men. Both born in London, they died during the same week, both of cancer, both aged 69. Coincidences that the media did not wait long to point out. Both men had also co-written plays that were to be produced at the same New York theater. The recent opening of Bowie's play Lazarus, co-written with Irish playwright Enda Walsh, and now in its final weeks at the New York Theatre Workshop, has figured heavily in the coverage of Bowie's death. Lazarus director Ivo van Hove was one of the very few people who had been aware of Bowie's illness, which had been a carefully guarded secret. It was immediately clear that it was very serious, van Hove told the New York Times. Although work on Lazarus had begun prior to Bowie's diagnosis, its themes dovetailed perfectly with his desire to leave behind a final set of works that would address his own death. Bowie's 27th studio album, Black Star, released just 2 days before he died, includes a track also entitled Lazarus. In the video, Bowie sings of heaven and levitates over a hospital bed before disappearing into a coffin-like wardrobe. As New York Theater Workshop artistic director James C. Nicola put it in the same a New York Times article. Quote, what seemed not too long ago intriguingly complicated and ambiguous and opaque now seems pretty clear. A man who is yearning for immortality. On Tuesday, as the cast themselves having been unaware of Bowie's illness, performed the play for the first time since Bowie's death, a video screen displayed a photo of Bowie, and fans placed flowers and notes in an improvised memorial outside the theater. Like Bowie, Rickman had also kept his cancer a secret, his death being announced Thursday morning in a simple statement from his family. Unlike Bowie, he is not known to have directly addressed his illness in his artistic output. Though Rickman was known to amass global audience for playing Professor Severus Snape in the Harry Potter films, he was political to the end. He gave his final on-screen performance alongside Helen Mirren in the drama Eye in the Sky, which he had described as a film about the moral responsibilities governments face regarding the use of drones. More strikingly, however, than the two men's differing approaches to their impending deaths was the very different manner in which their work had been treated by the same New York theater. In 2005, Rickman directed the initial London run of My Name is Rachel Corey, a play based on the writing of the U.S. activist crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza 2 years prior. Rickman had been moved to produce the work, staged at London's Royal Court Theatre, after reading Corey's published emails in 2003. Corey's friend Rochelle Grouse attended one performance accompanied by another friend of Corey's and shared her account with the Electronic Intifada. We sat through the play holding hands and shedding tears. Nothing is as odd as sitting in a theatre on the other side of the world watching a woman act as your murdered friend, using only words written by Rachel on a stage replicating your town, her bedroom, her spirit. The play was so well done, so powerful, and after it ended, Alan Rickman met us, bought us drinks, and sincerely asked us if we thought the play was an accurate depiction. Catherine Vinner, now editor-in-chief of The Guardian, was commissioned by Rickman to assist in editing the play. She shared her own memories of that time in an article this week. When asked recently about his, quote, when he asked recently about his proudest Royal Court moment, his answer was not about him, Vinner recalled of Rickman. He said it was when he took Rachel Corey's parents outside the front of the theater to show them their late daughter's name in neon lights. A wild success in London, the play was set to be staged in New York Theater Workshop in 2006, but the legacy of Rachel Corey was to meet with a very different treatment than that of David Bowie. As Vinner told Democracy Now, the production schedule was finalized. Both sides of the Atlantic had agreed on a press release that was going to go out to the press announcing the production of My Name is Rachel Corey, and then the Royal Court, as I was told, received a telephone call saying that the play was to be postponed indefinitely. Calling this production postponed does not disguise the fact that it has been canceled, said Rickman. This is censorship born out of fear, and the New York Theater Workshop, the Royal Court, New York audiences, all of us are the losers. Artistic director James C. Nicola cited a variety of reasons for the postponement, including the recent stroke of Israel's then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and, quote, distorted accounts of the actual circumstances of Rachel's death. While the Israeli government has always denied any responsibility for Corey's death, the circumstances of her killing remained the subject of active litigation in the United States and later in Israel through 2015. Quote, it seemed as though if we proceeded, we would be taking a stand we didn't want to take, Nicola told the New York Times, claiming that he had consulted local Jewish religious and community leaders to inform the decision. Whether any Palestinian religious or community leaders were consulted is unclear. A subsequent letter to the New York Times, signed by 24 cultural figures, including the Nobel Prize-winning playwright Harold Pinter and author and actor Stephen Fry, stated that quote, the various reasons given by the workshop, Prime Minister Sharon's coma, the election of Hamas, the circumstances of Rachel Corrie's death, the symbolism of her tale, make no sense in the context of this play and the crucial issues it raises about Israeli military activity in the occupied territories. Rachel Corrie gave her life standing up against injustice. A theater with such a fine history should have had the courage to give New York theatergoers the chance to experience her story for themselves. The letter concluded. This is a play really about my daughter, Rachel Corrie's father Craig told Democracy Now! Amid the controversy. It's through her words and a little bit of Rachel's mother Cindy and me and somebody else. To me, they should just let those words come out. Let our daughter talk for herself. The play was ultimately staged in New York's Minetta Lane Theater. Rickman, who until the late 2000s had been known outside his native United Kingdom, mainly as the swarmy antagonist in Die Hard, achieved global fame with his role as Snape in the Harry Potter movies. Since the 2006 debacle, others associated with the Harry Potter franchise have staked out opposing positions on Palestinian human rights. Miriam Margolyes, who portrayed Professor Sprout in the films, has described a single secular state for Israelis and Palestinians as the obvious solution. Author J.K. Rowling, however, signed a letter opposing boycotts of Israel. Rowling's literary agent, Neil Blair, is one of the driving forces behind the Culture for Coexistence, the anti-boycott group lauded in the letter. He's also a supporter of another coexistence group funded by Israel's Bank Hapoalim, which finances the construction of settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bowie, for his part, tended to eschew direct political commentary and is not known to have publicly weighed in on the subject of Israeli policy. He did perform in Israel several times, but his most recent concert there was in 1996, a decade before the Palestinian Civil Society call for a boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS. Friend and confidant Brian Eno, however, who produced three seminal records with Bowie in the late 1970s, recently co-authored a letter, of which Bowie was surely aware, calling on musicians to refrain from performing in Israel. Palestinians are not asking you to save them, the letter states. By calling for a boycott of Israel, they are only asking you not to help Israel oppress them. Eno also discussed the boycott in a video released last month. Rachel's cousin Beth Corrie posted the following statement to her personal Facebook page when she was granted permission to share. There will be many tributes to Alan Rickman, all richly deserved, but something very few will know about or mention is that Rickman was a very strong supporter of Palestinian human rights, and it was his idea, along with Catherine Vinner, an editor of the UK newspaper The Guardian, to take my cousin Rachel Corrie's emails and journals and turn them into an excellent play. This play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, has been performed all over the world, in multiple languages, and has brought Rachel's story to thousands of people. It has particularly inspired young people, who are moved by Rachel's willingness to break out of the script of success and do something with her youthful energy that saved lives, a witness for peace. Thank you, Mr. Rickman, for lending your artistic skill and considerable reputation to Rachel's story and making it accessible to so many people. And that's it. That's the article in the Electronic Intifada about Alan Rickman and David Bowie. You know, so even you can say, like, David Bowie definitely learned, probably engaged in some self-criticism about performing in Israel, for that matter. I mean, seeing he did not perform there after 1996. You know, and was friends, you know, pretty solid friends with people who were actively engaged in the boycott movement. So even if he didn't actually say anything about it, his actions certainly speak for themselves. And the fact that he did boycott Israel. You know, he did not perform in the apartheid state of Israel after 1996. And certainly since the BDS movement was announced, he never went there. And so Alan Rickman needs to be remembered for what he did there, for his political contributions to the BDS movement, and which are very, you know, very, very laudable. you know, and this side of him, like, really needs to be put out there. You know, he needs to be remembered for that, I would say, more than his portrayal of, you know, Harry Potter characters or what have you. You know, is that political contribution which he used his position as an actor to make, you know, that's really what he needs to be remembered for. That, and the kind of courage which he had to have to really put this out there and to really challenge the forces that were up against him in the UK and in the United States that were trying to censor him when he put out this play about Rachel Corrie. Now, I think in a tribute to him, because certainly that play was not the first time that Alan Rickman was engaged politically. In 1989, he performed a very interesting piece on the BBC. It was a monologue, which he did on the BBC, called The Preacher. It was written by a playwright named Peter Barnes. And it's about a priest, Jacques Roux, who was one of the most radical figures in the French Revolution. You know, he was one of the most outspoken forces trying to push for radical equality, you know, the dismantling of oppressive power structures and the advancement of the interests of working people in France at that time. You know, he was a proto-socialist, is basically what he was. You know, and basically he was one of the people, he was part of a loosely organized group of people called the Enrage. You know, they were the enraged ones who were pushing the most radical ideas in the French Revolution, and who inspired people like Gracchus Babeuf and these people who rose up in the 1790s and really can be called maybe the first socialists, the first modern socialists, and really kind of set the ball rolling with regard to these ideas that really were to culminate in the 1840s with Karl Marx and the development of historical materialism. You know, and communism is a strong mass ideology which shaped the modern era. So Alan Rickman portrayed this man who was known as the Red Priest in his time, you know, for his radical pronouncements and his radical actions. And he did this on BBC television in 1989. He did this performance, this monologue. So I think one of the best tributes I could give to him is actually to play this monologue on this show, which is what I'm going to do. So this is Alan Rickman with Revolutionary Witness, The Preacher, 1989. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
God created rich people first, and then showed them the world they would own. And when they came to a field with thousands of headless bodies with torsos and hands like iron, God told them the headless bodies were destined to be poor workers. The rich cried out, "But these heroes with their iron muscles will crush us." "Don't be frightened," answered God. "I shall place very small heads and brains on their bodies, so until they develop them, you've nothing to fear." Who are still the oppressors? The rich, who are still the oppressed, the poor. Your slavery is their liberty. Your poverty is their prosperity. Priests say the poor must be content with their poverty and they'll find heaven hereafter. Idiots, cretinous rag pickers. My dog George has more sense. Don't you know that whilst you're gazing up at heaven, your pockets are being picked clean, your eyes are plucked out, and you're robbed of your birthright, blind to what is done to you? Christ's priests seized mankind in its cradle and broke the bad news, saying, "You shapeless stench, you can never be anything but filth. Your only chance of winning a pardon for being so filthy is if you bow low in perfect humility in the face of all the afflictions, sorrows, and injustices heaped upon you. You're poor, and you stay poor. That is how it is meant to be. Life is a bitter ordeal. Don't speak out. Just try and save your worthless soul. You won't be able to, but you'll give us less trouble by trying. And when the time comes for you to die croaking, the darkness will be as hard to bear as the daylight ever was. The church knows its business. It offers fear and punishment, not happiness, certainly not liberty, only servitude, forever and forever. Religion is a liar and a cheat. Yet still you hunger for it. That's why you've sent for me, Jacques Roux, Mad Jacques, Red Roux, preacher of the poor, sower of sedition, subverter of all laws, a priest who saw the light of reason and now proclaims fellowship with all who live in dark dens and desolate places. It's fitting that I should preach perhaps my last sermon in a ruined church in the parish of St. Nicholas, Summer's End. I go before the tribunal tomorrow, charged with revolutionary excess. Now I am, it seems, too revolutionary for the revolution, and so it begins. When power rested in one man, King Louis, all sorts complained of oppression, and the nobility, middle and moneyed men called on the poor to help. Together, we lopped off that top branch of tyranny, but the tree still stands and spreads. New branches hide the sun of freedom from the poor. The Revolutionary Tribunal is one such. I don't recognize its authority to judge me. Only the poor of St. Nicholas can do that. I come here to lay the rags and tatters of my life before my peers. Habits are hard to break, citizens. I come to confess me. Hear my confession. Do not forgive me, Father, for I have not sinned. My own father had 12 children, and as I was the cleverest, he rid himself of me by sending me to school at the Angoulême Seminary. At 15, I was ordained a priest when I knew even less about God than I know now. There was a priest on every dunghill. The scummier they were, the more they sprouted. But I stayed on and became professor of philosophy, teaching students to bear with fortitude the misfortunes of others. Like religion, philosophy solves the problems of the past and the future, never the present. In 79, the Angoulême students rioted over the agony they saw around them and killed a cook by accident. As a suspect teacher with ideas, I was arrested and imprisoned, though I had nothing to do with the incident. A month or so later, I was released. No trial, no inquiry. Authority had decreed it, and I had no say in the matter whether I was to be free or in chains. This is how fires are kindled. Afterwards, I spent 4 years in the chair of experimental medicine at Angoulême, but medicine proved equally useless. Physicians know even less than philosophers and priests gangrened together. They lie. They all lie. Isn't that so, Georges? You tell him. I've grown hoarse in the telling. In 89, I was given this poor parish of St. Nicholas, and I was born into the real world of starvation and misery, and I saw the horror and the hope, too, for the revolution burst over us, smashed the clamps that held us down, and swept us up, up, with its transforming power. We opened the book we'd never read, and on the first page was the word liberty. Listen. Listen, the revolution was born in violence. Revolutions must be violent. It is the only way to end the greater violence that keeps the majority of mankind in servitude. Do you think that those with privileges would give them up without a fight because you have a charming smile and the best argument? Adjuro. Adjuro. I renounced my alliance to Rome and gave it to France. I became a constitutional priest, put off the mitred robes of privilege and put on the white robes of liberty. I still practice as priest and physician when called on, but I have to earn an honest living as a pamphleteer and municipal official. I live with a good woman, Widow Pettit, born Elizabeth Hubert, once laundress to the rich, now my helpmate, soulmate, who sells my pamphlets, 2 sous a copy. We adopted a son, Emile.
A sweet, sweet boy. No more of that. Not for your ears, or yours, or yours. My only fear, citizens, is not of death, but of a life without them. George knows. We love them, don't we, George, eh? I was elected a member of the Commune and spoke for the poor. I told Robespierre, Saint-Just, Brissot, and the rest that they could never be the revolution, just men, and not to be trusted with power. Anyone with authority becomes an oppressor, a parasitic coat of filth on the hide of the common people. Between those who command and those who obey, there is only hate. Does it follow that I reject all authority? No, but I always keep my hat on in its presence. In the matter of bread, I consult a baker. In the matter of boots, a bootmaker. A house, a builder. For special knowledge, I apply to a specialist. But I don't allow the baker, the bootmaker, or the builder to impose their authority over me. I listen to them with the respect they merit, if any, but I keep the right to judge, criticize, and censure. Why should we treat politicians of whatever stripe, royal or revolutionary, any different? I listen to King Louis, Mirabeau, Lafayette, the same way I listen to the baker and the bootmaker. Don't be fooled by those who set themselves above you. Always look at the bill they are presenting. You have to pay it. And criticize me, too. People thought Citizen Marat and I were enemies because we were forever attacking each other. He called me an extremist, this from a man who declared 300,000 heads weren't enough. But we were never enemies, just revolutionaries doing our duty. Neither of us were popular with the legislators, but it's not my purpose to be popular. I'm here to sting. To stop me stinging, the Assembly hired me to write the report of the King's execution. We didn't do that well, but you'll not squeeze one tear from my eye over the fate of a royal fool and his followers who talked of honour and died without it. To the boneyard with the whole crew, the rich we'll gobble up, tra-lee, tra-la, tra-lie, with truffles in the rump and oysters on each eye. I love the harp. That's how men and women should die. To the sound of harps, they're so precious. King Louis died to the sound of drums. As the recording officer, I went with Citizen Santerre to the Temple prison to escort the king to the place of execution. Santerre brought a carriage and a guard of honor for the occasion. We drove through streets lined with citizens. They had 3 executioners waiting, 3 and 18 drummers. What extravagance is just to kill one man. The knife fell. Louis's head fell with it. The crowd shouted, "Long live the Republic!" And then I saw Citizen Santerre and the other revolutionary officials dipping their handkerchiefs in the king's blood. I wrote it all up in my report, but I was the only one who seemed disgusted by the whole spectacle. Invading armies were about to overwhelm Paris. There was civil strife in the Vendée, rebellions in Lyon and Bordeaux, and good men and women were dying everywhere, defending the revolution, even as the traitorous Louis was dying on the scaffold. But the good and the true had no carriages, no 18 drummers and 3 executioners. A Prussian sword in the belly, an English bullet in the chest, and falling face down in the mud was their end. That's how ordinary people die. Meanly, without harps or even drums to play them out, that Louis, that useless toe rag of a man, goes in style as anemic blood gathered up as something precious. A month later, remember, I led the attack on the Paris food merchants. I'm proud of that attack. Those in power condemn me for it, so I know it must have been right. We ask only for food, a home, a little ease, no more crying in the streets. Bread, bread, for God's sake. We were at war, and so we accepted such hardships if they were equally shared, but they weren't. We were dying because of filthy bourgeois graft and greed. The slimy, rapacious, money-mad exploiters were hoarding food to raise the price on the open market. Legislators wrung their hands, threatened with a whisper, and did nothing. So we flat bellies marched. smashed stalls, broke up at shops and warehouses and found the bread and meat and other foodstuffs they'd hidden in abundance. They asked us why we did it. We told them because we needed it. Citizen Marat said we should kill every merchant in sight. We made do with a few score strung up in front of their own shops to encourage the others. And it did. The next morning, the food markets were filled again with fruit and vegetables, bread and meat. Like Jesus, we had performed a miracle of the loaves and fishes. We must appropriate the land and money from the rich who have it in excess and give it to those who need it and live in want. The only way to defend and save the revolution is by pushing it as far as it'll go and then further, and that's never far enough for me. Then Citizen Marat died. Steel through the heart, painless, when he'd had such a painful life. I miss him. No one left to trust. That's why I agreed to become editor of his paper when his staff asked me to keep the bright flame burning. So when those impotent, excremental conformists, Robespierre and the Jacobin gang, banned women from political power, we took up the cause. They wanted liberty for themselves alone. I wrote that those refugees from the leper house of reaction should be belled and booted headfirst into the nearest sewer. In return, they persuaded Marat's widow Catherine to denounce me to the revolutionary tribunal for besmirching her husband's memory. Poor sweet Catherine. Grief takes many forms. She wanted to protect her husband's fame. She thought I was trying to take it from him in some way. I shun fame. It always costs too much. Late last night, I went walking through the streets of Paris with Georges. Just the two of us. Georges padding beside me, sniffing every post and doorway, and me smoking my pipe. Oh, there's nothing better. Making love, perhaps. Or making a revolution. But with a revolution, you have to be right. It was a clear night. And empty streets, and as we passed St. Nicholas's church, something strange happened. I was walking, but suddenly I couldn't hear my own footsteps. Not one. Silence. I was a dead man walking. No more of that. Tomorrow, before the tribunal of mumblers, I shall make no attempt to defend myself. That doesn't mean to say I'll stay silent. Never that. I'll do what I was born to do. Attack. If the verdict of that bunch of rotting fish heads goes against me, I die like friend Marat, though struck down by a better hand. My own.